backseat, polish and cram, we're going down, going down.
Well, Bush 2 is in the White House, just passing tax reforms, giving trillions to his rich friends, and stealing from the poor. Don't blink your eyes, he'll sell the store.
Corporations and the Pentagon just cooking up the wars. Condos in the State House, ancient world, in the Ocon, in the Ocon.
Well, Poppy Bush and Baby Bush and the Party of God, that spelled G for guns and O for oil and D for drugs. They gave us 911. Was an inside job.
George Bush in the White House, spreading fear across the land, tearing up our Bill of Rights as fast as they can. War on terror, such a scam.
Well, Collins at the UN just showing diagrams. Can't you see those weapons just scattered across the land? He's making deals, he's shaking hands.
Got blood on his hands. Wolfie's at the World Bank making new demands. We'll take your oil, you keep the sand.
We got Abu Ghraib in the Middle East, Guantanamo down south. Congress got that Patriot Act just shoved on down its mouth. It took our Constitution and threw it out.
We'll call over in the White House and they say he's Bush's brain. All his corporate buddies and their voting machines. We cast our votes, they wipe them clean.
Neo-Nazis stole the White House, now they're shooting for the world. Torture and police states and preemptive war. The Fourth Reich's here in America.
King George in the White House is pushing folks around. Cheney's in the backseat, polishing the crown. We're going down, we're going down.
You're listening to KHEN LPFM Radio 106.9 Salida, Colorado, community supported radio. We are streamed on the internet at khen.org, and if you'd like to listen to tonight's program or any past programs of Truth Quest, they are now available at www.givemesometruth.info or linked from khen.org website. I am Melody, and my co-host tonight is Dr. Eric Carlstrom and Katie O'Brien. And our special guest tonight is Jerry E. Smith. And this opening song was White House Blues, performed and written by Dr. Eric Carlstrom. And again, KHEN is... Oops. And I'm hoping we got everybody here. Do we have Jerry, Katie? Can you hear me?
Katie? Yeah.
There you guys go. Takes a minute here to get everything figured out, but I think I've got everybody. And I wanted to get some... Okay, support for KHEN and Truth Quest, brought to you by Kevin Barnes, agent for Land Properties, Inc.'s Little River Ranch, offering beautiful land home packages with underground utilities and river access just 3 miles from historic downtown Salida. Find out more at coloradohomeproperties.com or call Kevin at 719-207-0858. And Jerry E. Smith was born in 1950 in Panoma, California, is the author, poet, editor, and activist. His bibliography of published works includes scores of nonfiction articles, reviews, and more than a dozen ghostwritten books and 3 nonfiction books from Adventures Unlimited Press. He's a close friend and literary partner of the late Jim Keith. They worked together on magazines, books, and co-hosted a radio show broadcast from the campus of the Oregon Institute of Technology. Jerry Smith's first book from Adventures Unlimited Press was HARP, H-A-A-R-P, The Ultimate Weapon of Conspiracy, which considered conspiracy theories connected to high-frequency active auroral research project. The book, published in 1998, was
has been described as blurring the lines between fiction and nonfiction by detractors and as comprehensive and erudite by other reviewers. His other book that he has done is Weather Warfare, written in 2006, and covers the history of weather modification from the rainmakers of the 1890s through the development of cloud seeding in the middle of the 20th century to today's suspected ability to manipulate hurricanes. Katie,
yes.
Are you there? And Dr. Carlstrom?
Yes, I'm here.
Okay, great. And Jerry?
Yes, I am here.
Okay, Jerry, do you have anything to add to your biography there to kind of...
Well, that's from Wikipedia, and I made the mistake of putting that up on Wikipedia myself, and apparently that's a no-no, and the Wikipedia Nazis got very huffy about it and threatened to take it down, and then edited it rather interestingly, that they decided it wasn't objective enough, so they had to find a detractor, so that quote where it says that I blurred the lines between fiction and nonfiction, that's from a website in which the guy goes on for a couple of paragraphs about how wrong I am. Then at the end of it, he admits, but I haven't actually read his book.
That's objective journalism, yes.
Well, before we get too far, let me say the views expressed on this program are those of myself or my guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of KHIN staff, volunteers, or board of directors. Okay, we'll let you go ahead from here. Dr. Carlstrom, do you have anything you'd like to...
Yes, Melody, I do. Thank you very much. Jerry, it's a pleasure to have you on the radio show. I've got a copy of your book, HARP, The Ultimate Weapon of the Conspiracy, which you wrote in 1998, and a copy of your Weather Warfare book. I would like to jump right into the fray, if it's okay with you. I've got a website about 911. And the New World Order files is what it's called. I can give that website link a little bit later. But basically, what I'm coming around to after having studied this for many years is seriously considering the ideas of Dr. Judy Wood that would suggest that the Twin Towers, World Trade Center 1 and 2, came down by, at least in part, by directed energy weapons of some kind, she calls exotic weapons. And I know you wrote your book HARP in 1998, but I assume you've been keeping up with HARP, and I would like to ask your opinion as to whether HARP might account for the way those Twin Towers exploded and came down at the speed of gravity, basically with molecular dissociation of concrete and steel.
Well, that is an interesting take. I have not heard that before, to tell you the truth. My understanding of HARP is that it is not that focusable. It's not that directable. HARP is a field of antennas on the ground in southeastern Alaska, so linked together as to work as one giant antenna. And it is today the world's largest radio broadcasting station. But it's not designed to broadcast for human ears. It's designed to inject a fantastic amount of radio frequency energy into a spot at the very top of the atmosphere called the ionosphere. Now, the amount of energy that the field can currently output, and it was just completed the ribbon cutting ceremony to announce that they had finished building the HARP. The ribbon cutting ceremony was a year ago. I think it was like 13 months ago. But the evidence supports that they actually finished completing it right around Thanksgiving 2005, and it was announced as being completed by DARPA, the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, in March of 2006, and yet the principal contractor, BAE Systems North America, dallied until the contract ran out before doing the ribbon-cutting ceremony. Now, the amount of energy that this thing can inject into the atmosphere is 3.6 million watts. The largest legal AM radio station in the United States is 50,000 watts. HARP is 72,000. 50,000-watt radio stations, injecting their entire effective radiated power into a spot about 12.5 miles across by about 2.5 miles deep by 50 or 90 miles up, depending on which mode they're operating in. Now, what that does is that heats that spot by several thousand degrees to the point where the molecules of the atmosphere literally blow apart. And when you break the molecules, that gives off a packet of energy, which includes a stream of ELF, extremely low frequency radio waves. And these ELF waves penetrate deep into the earth and deep into the sea. And the U.S. Navy admits to having used HARP to communicate with deeply submerged submarines for about 15 years now. HARP, at the time that the towers went down, HARP was in in a phase called the developmental prototype, with an effective radiated power of 960 kilowatts, substantially less than what it is now, but still, at the time, one of the world's greatest radio broadcasting stations. Now, the deal is that the ELF is such a long wave, it does circumnavigate the globe. So the whole world is directly affected by the ionospherically generated ELF. Though whether that can be focused at a building anywhere on the planet, much less specifically New York City, is I think rather extreme conjecture. Though it's hard to rule it out because we don't really know exactly what this thing can do.
Right. Of course, HARP includes and builds upon some of the exotic inventions of Nikola Tesla, the inventor who lived in the late 1800s and early 1900s. And one of his many, many inventions is, as you know, one of the greatest inventors, perhaps the greatest inventor of the last couple of hundred years anyway, was what he calls the death ray, or he called the death ray, where he described this, and of course I think he did patent these things, but much of that material was stolen upon his death, supposedly by the government. And this death ray, he called it a teleforce, that he could essentially melt airplane motors at a distance of 250 miles. And one of the reasons why I make this conjecture is that, I don't know if you've read the work of Dr. Judy Wood, but she talks about 130 toasted cars, and these had engine blocks that were just completely destroyed. Very mysterious effects were associated with the coming down of the Twin Towers, and have never really before been seen. These kinds of effects haven't been seen. So this is one of the reasons why I've made this conjecture.
But the Tesla death ray was one of the things I researched while writing the HARP book, and I concluded that HARP was not the death ray, and so only put minimal mention of it in the book, just so that the readers would know, yeah, I had researched it and moved on. But the death ray concept was an interesting idea that was played with over the following century by a number of governments. The idea, if I can remember this even sort of coherently, was that it was a two-phase thing. First of all, is he ionized a zone of the atmosphere to create a virtual wire to run the power down, and then a build-up and discharge of electrical energy down the ionized zone, similar to lightning. And he never actually got up to the point of working with hardware. It was all in his head. There were a number of notes, and I think there were a couple of patents, but I'm not sure. But I do know that the Soviets played with it. Actually, initially the French played with it between World War I and II. I think the French were playing with it in the 1920s. They abandoned it. They managed to only get it to go a few hundred yards. And then the Russians played with it, and they managed to get it to go about a quarter mile. They actually succeeded in frying a goat a quarter mile away from the transmitter, which showed promise, but the amount of energy and the lack of sophistication of the equipment of the 1930s convince both the French and the Soviets to abandon that line of research. And it's possible that that line of research has been picked up. I keep hearing rumors and stories about it, but there is if anybody has this technology, it is currently classified. Though there have been some wild stuff, like the Japanese doomsday cult was playing with some aspect of Tesla broadcast power and sending fireballs across the Australian outback in the 90s, and this may be related technology or may not, may be parallel development. It's hard to say.
Okay, well, let me just follow this up, Jerry. What you said about the death ray being causing an ionized zone in the atmosphere and then a discharge of energy down that ionized zone. Dr. Judy Wood she's got a PhD in engineering, materials engineering, and what she did in her study was to get all the photos she could of just before, just after, weeks after, months after the event of the Twin Towers. And she's had to develop a new vocabulary for the things that she sees, because there's nothing in our experience that really describes them. So the one thing that she describes is just before the towers, both towers came down, just before each of the towers came down, there's kind of a smoke. What she calls the towers get lathered up. There's a kind of a film of smoke that's seen on the outside of the towers that goes up quite a ways, and this immediately precedes the explosive destruction of the towers. And your description of the ionizing going on and then the discharge of energy down it like a lightning bolt sounds feasible. And then you certainly see molecular dissociation of the particles, so that the concrete and the steel are completely shattered, sent apart into nanoparticles.
Right. So we certainly do. It certainly does look like something other than conventional explosives was used. So it's not an area I have researched in any great depth. My take up until we had this conversation was that the buildings had been pre-wired for explosives, with explosives, because of the first attack on the towers in 93. The plan was to undermine the side of one so that it fell into the other, creating a domino effect and knocking down skyscrapers all across Manhattan in a wave of falling skyscraper dominoes. And there's a lot of people who think that at that point they wired the building so that if there were a second attack, they could prevent the domino effect from occurring. So that's kind of what I'd been thinking up until 20 minutes ago when you
well,
laid this
idea. There is good evidence. I think that there were pre-setting of explosions did occur, and certainly there were big explosions that rocked the buildings, particularly the lower floors. But the upper two-thirds seem to have been destroyed in a very unconventional manner, and different people suggest mini nukes and or directed energy weapons, which could include microwaves and all kinds of ELFs, I guess, or the death ray or something like that. And so this is, as you say, it's conjecture, but Judy Wood has done a lot of research, and she throws out a lot of these possibilities, and we have a pretty good inkling that many of these technologies do exist. So it's just
right.
A matter
well,
of
I do bring up in both the books, HARP, The Ultimate Weapon of the Conspiracy, and Weather Warfare, The Military's Plan to Draft Mother Nature, that there are a lot of unconventional and reprehensible technologies that have been under development for the last century, and that one of the things that I bring up in HARP is the military. Let me collect my thoughts here for a moment. Non-conventional warfare You may remember after the collapse of the Soviet Union, there was all this talk about the peace dividend, which never really quite developed. And then there was the big talk was RMA, the Revolution in Military Affairs. And this was because we were moving from nukes, which are a somewhat unconventional conventional weapon, into very unconventional weapons, electromagnetic weapons. The big deal, and you do a, you can do a Google on this and find some amazing stuff. RMA, Revolution in Military Affairs, is the idea that we go through an RMA every time we change the fundamentals of how war is fought, such as when we went from cold steel to arrows, and we went from arrows to bullets, and from bullets to cannons. You know, we have gone from weapons that target individuals to weapons that target battlefields, to weapons that target cities, as with nukes, to weapons that, that target whole regions with electromagnetics. And that's where we stand now with weather weapons and electromagnetics, perhaps scalar weapons. We can target whole continents, maybe even whole planets. And that's an RMA, and that's one of the aspects that I discuss directly and indirectly in both those books.
Could you describe a little bit more about what you're talking about? I think you know, most of us have only a very vague idea of what you're mentioning when you talk about these electromagnetic weapons, these scalar weapons, and how they would be used, and how they would work.
As we discussed before we went on the air, I kind of need to borrow your eyes and mouth here for a moment. I want to
sure.
give a quote. My my book, Weather Warfare, begins with a quote from Secretary of Defense William S. Cohen. And the key to that quote is at the bottom of the first paragraph where it goes, others are developing. Do you have that handy? Can you?
Yeah.
Can you, yeah.
I'll do it. Katie, you want to do it?
Sure. So there are plenty of ingenious minds out there that are at work.
A little higher up where it says,
others are engaged even in an eco-type of terrorism, whereby they can alter the climate, set off earthquakes, volcanoes remotely through the use of electromagnetic waves.
It's real, and that's the reason why we have to intensify our efforts. Now, Secretary Cohen said that in his official capacity as the Secretary of Defense at a conference on
terrorism,
weapons of mass
destruction in the U.S. strategy, given on the 28th of April in 97.
Right, 97. I mean, this is the Secretary Cohen said that there are others, and of course, whenever the U.S. Government says that other eight governments have this capacity. They're saying that because they themselves have this capacity. And he says others, and he doesn't necessarily say other governments. This, of course, is a conference on terrorism, so he's implying that Libya and Al-Qaeda are in possession of this, and he maybe has been speaking directly about the Japanese doomsday cult. And he says, can, not will, maybe, sometime in the future, he says, can alter the climate, set off volcanoes, earthquakes remotely through the use of electromagnetic waves. And that's one of the areas here. There have been developments in radio frequency technologies that are completely outside the ken of what Americans know about or what's being released on the 6 o'clock news. A little bits and pieces of this are coming out. You started with a quote from Wikipedia on my bio. Another page of Wikipedia that would be of interest is the active denial system. Your listeners might want to drop in on the Wikipedia page on the active denial system. It was first announced by the Marines as the VMAD, the vehicle-mounted active denial system. And basically, the VMAD is a microwave oven without a door mounted on top of a Hummer that you aim it at a crowd and the skin temperature of the people in the area being irradiated goes up about 180 degrees in less than 2 seconds. This is an electromagnetic crowd control device that I think is hilarious. The way we learned about this is in 2003, a reporter for one of the major periodicals like Popular Science got a hold of this thing and announced and dropped a note to the Marines saying, "Hey, you know, I know you guys have this thing, and we're going to run an article on it. You have anything to say?" And the general in charge of the Marines flipped out and said, "I'm not going to let them scoop me," and ordered that the Marine Monthly Magazine put it on the front cover so that they outed themselves as having this thing and touted it and had some artist renderings of it and yada yada. And then hilariously, 2 or 3 years later, the Air Force announces that they have it and pretend that they just got it and they're the only people and it's brand new, completely ignoring the fact that the Marines had already had it for 3 years.
And I found it interesting about this weapon that basically after your skin heats up and they turn it off, it makes everybody laugh.
I hadn't heard that one, but
I saw a demonstration of it, and it was just amazing. I mean, they would get very hot, they'd back off, and then they were all laughing.
I do remember seeing something like 60 Minutes or something carrying this thing. So that's what we mean when we say an electromagnetic weapon. That is, electromagnetics is radio frequency. And there are lots of these things out there. Some they have admitted to, some they haven't admitted to. Another one is an artificial electromagnetic pulse generator. They discovered in 1964 with the Johnston Atoll nuke shot that there was something called the EMP, the electromagnetic pulse, which was a pulse of electromagnetic energy that came out from an atomic detonation, and it fried out the electronics of everything associated with it. And so you've probably heard about hardened equipment, hardened silos, etc. The hardening is not to prevent the shockwave from crashing it. It's designed to prevent the EMP from crashing the electronics. And from the moment they discovered that atom bombs produced EMPs, they've been trying to artificially make one. And the Air Force has been working on a gizmo they called Hermes. And Hermes 3 was deployed in Gulf War 1. And they had a battlefield-ready EMP generator in Gulf War 1. And there's a great deal of debate as to whether or not HAARP is capable of being an EMP generator. And I am quite convinced that it is. Again, when you heat up the ionosphere by several thousand degrees, that blows apart the molecules of the atmosphere and converts them from a gas to a plasma, which is an electrically charged gas. And because it's at the top of the atmosphere, that electrically charged gas goes out into space. As a side note, this means every time they use HAARP, they throw away a chunk of our atmosphere, which I think is a pretty dumb thing to do. So this plume of electrically charged gas goes out into space, and it keeps going out until it runs into something to stop it, which is the magnetic lines of force of the Earth's magnetic field. And it hits the magnetic lines of force, gets trapped between the lines of force, and spreads out, forming a shield. HAARP is a ground-based Star Wars weapon system that is that generates this shell of electrically charged particles that anything electronic moving through would be disrupted or destroyed by. So it could be used to fry out passing spy satellites or incoming ICBMs.
When you mention a plume of electrically charged gas or a plasma, again, this reminds me of the pictures that Judy Wood shows of the World Trade Center Towers 1 and 2 immediately before they came down, when she said the towers were being, quote, lathered up.
It does sound very similar. Again, there are a lot of variations on this theme, and I hesitate to say HAARP did it, but HAARP-like technology is under development in a lot of different labs for a lot of different purposes and a lot of different applications, and there may indeed have been something HAARP-like used on the towers.
And
yeah,
what would a positive example of HAARP usage be?
What would a positive example of RTH be? Well, DARPA, the Defense Advanced Research Project Agency, was given the job of completing HAARP, and they listed four things that they had done with HAARP. And if I had a copy of the book in front of me, I had to run to another building to get to this phone, so I didn't bring my notes with me. But in the there's a in Weather Warfare, there's an extensive chapter updating HAARP, and in there I quote verbatim the DARPA webpage, and they list four things that they have done with HAARP, which includes the first item is two separate different things under one bullet, which is the generation, the ionospheric generation of ELF and VLF for subsurface communications, and at the same time, what they call the reduction of population densities of radioactive particles in the radiation belts for safe spacecraft operations. So they put a smiley face on this generating a plume of plasma, and they point out that this plasma goes out until it hits the magnetic lines of force, which is the inner Van Allen belt, and overburdens the Van Allen belt and forces it to precipitate, to rain out, which makes it which reduces how much radiation is in the belt, so you can shoot spacecraft through it. Though I can assure you there has not been an environmental impact study done of what happens when you rain hard radiation back to Earth by this technique.
Can you explain what the VLF is?
Well, radio frequency spectrum, the electromagnetic spectrum, runs from 0 hertz per minute, or 0 hertz, you know, it's measured in hertz. It runs from very, very long radio waves that are hundreds of miles long to radio waves that are microscopic, billionths of a second long, up at X-rays and gamma rays. So there's the electromagnetic spectrum includes what we use for radio, television, visible light, microwaves, and hard radiation, gamma, alpha, etc. And ELF is at extremely low frequency, is the lowest frequency from 0 to 10 hertz. And then there's ultra low and very low and low frequency, and then high frequency, and very high frequency, and ultra high frequency. And if you have a TV set with two dials on it, one is VHF and one is UHF. Those are the TV bands. And above TV is microwave, which cooks your TV dinner. And above that, you have the stuff that gets generated in atomic piles.
Yeah. Again, be a little provocative, a lot of people are wondering what happened with Hurricane Katrina and what happened with the Christmas tsunami of 2004 right next to Indonesia. Do you have an opinion as to whether, number one, it's possible that some of these weapons were used to trigger these events, or number two, whether they actually were?
I do indeed have an opinion, and it's my opinion based on several decades of research is a little different from the what you get in internet scuttlebutt. Let's go back to HAARP's completion date. HAARP was officially completed in 2007, but by BAE Systems, the contractor who built it. It was officially completed in 2006 by DARPA, who had the contract to hire, who had the authority to hire BAE Systems to build it. And then the observers on the ground paying attention to HAARP saw that throughout 2005, each day there would be an hour or two of testing of the radio frequency in the evening. So what they figured was going on was that during the day they put up the antennas and the transmitters and wired them up, and then at night they tested the wiring to see if what they'd done during the day had actually worked or not. And they completed doing this daily testing a few days before Thanksgiving 2005, which was somewhat after Katrina. 2005 was the worst hurricane season ever, largest number of named storms, largest number of Category 4 and 5 storms ever to make landfall, which included Katrina and Rita and Wilma and so forth. So the likelihood of HAARP being involved in that is fairly slim. However, what happened the next year? If you remember, during 2005, the weather pundits were saying that the 2006 season was going to be even worse. And what happened? Nothing.
Nothing.
And 2007? Nothing. And 2008? Nothing. What I believe happened, and I can't prove this, it's speculation relegated to the last chapter of the Weather Warfare book, was I believe what happened is that they rushed HAARP into completion 2 years ahead of schedule so that they could bring it online in time for the 2006 hurricane season. And if you remember, during the 2006 hurricane season, a couple of days before the hurricane season began, a mysterious, anomalous high-pressure dome appeared over the southeastern United States and stayed over the southeastern United States until a few days after the official end of the hurricane season, and then this dome mysteriously dissipated. That dome worked like a rubber bumper on a pinball machine, and hurricanes like pinballs crashed into it and bounced off and were thrown off safely back out to sea. This happened in 2006 and again 2007, and it seems to be occurring again so far in 2008. I believe that the pundits said in 2006 that the mysterious high pressure dome, which had never before been seen, was caused by El Nino. 2007, no El Nino, still have the dome. 2008, no El Nino, still have the dome. Now you might be thinking, well, if HAARP is used as a hurricane shield, why aren't they, saying, hey, we did it, we saved the coast, we're heroes. Well, look at what's going on under that high pressure dome. Drought, wildfires, destruction of property, death to shut-ins from the heat, etc. If they were to take responsibility for saving the coast, they would also admit responsibility for frying the interior. And they don't dare do that, so they're just keeping mum on the subject.
So what would be their motivation for having done that? Just as an experiment, or
to
benefit,
was,
or to...
2006 was an election year. Election year politics generally are anything that's good reflects well on the status quo. Those who wish to remain in power will do whatever it takes to make things good, at least for the few weeks before the election. I think that's the long and the short of it, is that it was an election year and they pulled out all the stops to try and retain power. Once they had it up and running and it worked, they went, hey, cool, look at that, and did it again. And now it's an election year again, a crucial election year, and they're doing it again.
And they would be the military or the people that are actually working with HAARP?
Well, I don't think it's either of them. As I point out in my HAARP book, the military follows orders. My big complaint with the previous book on HAARP, which was by Nick Begich and Gene Manning, Angels Don't Play This HAARP, is that they looked at all the science behind HAARP. They really did a fine job on what, where, when, how, and left out who and why. All they really did was prove this is a military project, and then say civilian good, military bad. It's a military project, therefore it's bad. We're done. And I went, no. The military is like a bulldozer. You know, it follows orders. There's a driver. The driver, and the driver has his work order. Somebody tells him what to do with the bulldozer. The military is a blunt instrument who follows orders. It's got to be above the military. It's got to be the people who give the military orders have got to be the people who are really behind the program.
So who is funding HARP?
That's a good question. What we know is that the primary funding is from the U.S. Navy. And the U.S. Navy gets it from primarily from Senate appropriations. The Congress tells the Navy, okay, you can spend this money. The Navy then gives it, doled it out to DARPA. DARPA then doled it out to BAE Systems. BAE Systems then doled it out to subcontractors to put the thing together. And over the last 20 years, they've spent around $300 million on it, which for a DOD project is ridiculously cheap.
Okay. So that brings us over to Banda Aceh in Indonesia and the big tsunami, which was triggered, of course, by a big earthquake that happened under the ocean.
Right. You know, I studied that at great length, and I'm actually still researching it. It didn't end up in the weather warfare book because I haven't completed my research on it yet. There is a lot of conflicting indicators. There's a lot of conflicting evidence as to what happened in what order, and what we know there was a large seismic event. The question is, what triggered the large seismic event? And in weather warfare, I have a whole chapter. In HARP, I have a sub-chapter on earthquakes on demand. We know the science is clear that there are half a dozen ways that humans can inadvertently, unintentionally create earthquakes. And we know from that there have been a couple of intentional earthquakes created by humans, one of which was Project Faultless, which Project Faultless was the late 1960s. You may know that the Nevada test site is about 90 miles from Las Vegas, and for the first years of the Cold War era, the bombs were set off above ground. And in the 50s, it was a big deal, a big tourist draw to go to Vegas and see a nuke shot. And there were atomic cocktails and atomic hairdos and whatnot. As the bombs got bigger, there was the test ban treaty, and that put all the bombs underground, and then they got really big. And as the bombs got bigger, the buildings in Vegas rocked and shook more. And at one point, Howard Hughes, who owned half a dozen casinos in Vegas, got rattled, quite literally. And he'd had enough of frightened tourists and broken glass and ordered the Nevada test site to move. And Hughes actually had enough oomph, had enough power to get them to agree, yeah, we can't do any more really big ones here. We need a site far away from humans. And they did eventually end up on an island in the Kamchatkas, or an island in the Aleutians, off of Kamchatka. But they initially tried central Nevada, and they decided to intentionally place the biggest bomb, and it turned out to be the biggest bomb ever detonated in the continental United States, intentionally on a fault line to see if it would induce an earthquake. Of course, they assumed it wouldn't, so they called it Project Faultless. But they were dead wrong. And not only did it set off the fault zone it was on, it set off one on the other side of the valley. There were disruptions of between 10 and 15 feet along both of those fault lines, dropping the valley floor by an average of 8 feet, at which point they realized, oops, and moved it off. But that is a well-established, well-documented case of humans intentionally creating an earthquake and subsequent damage. My contention is that if you can do it accidentally the first time, you can do it intentionally the second time. And we know there's half a dozen different ways of doing these things. And that that's from mechanical, but not from electromagnetics. And there are a number of electromagnetic indicators. And I give the Tenseng earthquake that killed 650,000 people in China as an example. Dr. Andreich Puharich was convinced that that earthquake was generated by electromagnetic means, and part of the evidence of this was that half an hour before the earthquake, there were wild lights in the sky, and vegetables growing in the ground were fried on one side as if subjected to a very high heat. There was a recent earthquake in China with exactly the same phenomena. And these days we have YouTube, and if you go to YouTube, you can actually see the wild colors in the sky 15 minutes before the earthquake happened.
And what would be the cause of those then? Could you pin it down to a certain...
You know, this is the great thing about using natural systems as a weapon. Mother Nature gives great credible deniability. It's extremely difficult to trace back where to even establish that a weapon was used, much less where the weapon was located when it was used.
Yeah.
So there's no way to really trace these back to their origin. They just kind of happen, and you have to see what's out there in regard to where they might point.
Exactly. What I've come to is that if you can find no natural explanation for it, then you may be looking at an unnatural explanation. As I said, this anomalous high pressure dome over the southeastern United States is now in its third year, and it's never existed before. This thing has never been seen before. There is no natural explanation for why a high pressure dome would park itself over a region of the country for an extended period of time.
Well, we do have the Bermuda highs, which are just in that area, and they flow back and forth over the continent and the ocean. But what you're saying was anomalous was that it just stayed in one place?
Exactly. It stayed in one place conveniently for the entire length of the hurricane season, 2006-2007.
One thing that was brought up by some people that I know that was kind of following that event was that weather pattern had kind of parked itself right along where the proposed Trans-Texas corridor was, and
exactly.
Inundated.
That was big scuttlebutt on the internet last year. The high pressure dome in 2006 was huge and didn't allow moisture hardly at all onto the North American continent. They seem to have fine-tuned it a bit and reduced it in size. So then, 2007, it stopped the Atlantic hurricanes, but coming up from the Yucatan is what the locals call the Yucatan Express,
uh-huh.
Which is moisture comes up around the western side of the western shore of the Gulf of Mexico, and up from the Yucatan, up southern Texas, and then into the southeast. And the smaller dome stopped the Yucatan Express over central Texas and dumped rain right dead over the spot where they are planning to build this North American free trade superhighway. It's supposed to be 16 lanes wide, 8 in each direction, right smack up the center of Texas. And there had just been some politics on this, and that the Texas government had initially said that they were going to use eminent domain to take this property, and the Texas legislature passed laws making it a whole lot harder for the administration to just grab this property. And then immediately thereafter, there was conveniently all this rain and flooding, leading many people to speculate that it was intentional to flood out the homeowners so the government could pick up the property pennies on the dollar.
Well, isn't there also some speculation on some of the flooding that took place in Iowa this year in the same note?
You know, I wouldn't be surprised. I haven't heard it, but I haven't gone out looking for internet scuttlebutt recently. And this, you know, this sort of thing comes up repeatedly. What was it, 10, 15 years? Yeah, 10, 12 years ago, there was drought and wildfire in Idaho, Montana, in the same areas where there was very active militia movements and patriot groups. And there was a lot of patriot groups saying that they're trying to burn us out.
We had something similar happen in Colorado in regard to Pinyon Canyon. The government went in and wanted to buy up a bunch of land, and the owners and citizens of the county said no, and within about a week it was on fire.
Mm, exactly.
But again...
It's very difficult because Mother Nature gives great credible deniability. You can say it was... you can say anything and pretty much get away with it because it's extremely difficult to prove anything along these lines.
Yet you have.
Well, yeah, I was going to say that myself, and I teach a course in climatology and have done for a long time, and know how very complex our weather and climate systems are. In fact, they're enormously complex. So I would like to, if you could maybe explain in a kind of a nutshell how the HAARP weapon could maneuver this high-pressure dome to a particular spot and keep it there.
I got to tell you, I'm not a meteorologist. I'm not scientifically versed in that. In fact, the science I know is I'm a geologist, and particularly volcanism and plate tectonics. So if you want to talk about igneous intrusions and subduction zones, I'm with you. But when it comes to atmospheric dynamics, I just have to take what scientists tell me is what they say it is, and I have to take their word for it or not, as the case may be.
I'll just throw out then that the whole science of chaos and chaos theory comes out of the study of meteorology. This idea of sensitive dependence on initial conditions, that a butterfly can flap his wings in Iowa and this can spawn a hurricane off the Atlantic Ocean. That there's a cascade of unexpected consequences from very, very small forcing factors can cause unexpected results, so that it's impossible for meteorologists to predict the weather after 5 days. Because
exactly.
Then there's so many of these things that can happen and go in so many different directions that statistically they can't make good predictions after 5 days. So as a person who teaches climatology, I would be very interested to know how the HAARP system could move these major pressure systems around and guide them. I think it's possible in the sense that, I've read that they can move hurricanes. Well, hurricanes are low-pressure systems. What you're talking about is a high-pressure system.
Right.
So,
but these
are responding to temperature variations on the surface, which then cause relative wind speeds. So what you're dealing with is a system where you have differences in heat, you have differences in wind, you have differences in air pressure, and then this becomes a guiding mechanism for storms. So it's very complex, and I sure would like to know how HAARP can affect that system.
Well, some of that is given in the HAARP patents, and I give the very first HAARP patent at the back of the HAARP book. Dr. Bernard Eastland led a team at APTI, which was originally ARCO Power Technologies Incorporated, and then they realized that putting the ARCO in the name kind of gave away a little too much and changed it to Advanced Power Technologies Incorporated. And Dr. Eastland and his team came up with the 12 basic patents that HAARP is based on. But of course the people at HAARP say, oh no, that's not us, because that's a ground-based armored weapon system, and we're not, so we're not it. But the proof that they are those patents is that the company that owns the patents has changed hands repeatedly, and each time the ownership of the company changes, the ownership of the intellectual property changes, and the new owners get the contract. APTI got the initial contract to build HAARP. They got bought by E-Systems. E-Systems then got the contract. E-Systems was then bought out by Raytheon. Raytheon got the contract. Raytheon then spun off its E-Systems division and sold it to BAE Systems North America, who then got the contract, which I think is proof that indeed those patents are the basis of HARP. And in those patents, it describes how the weather can be manipulated, particularly how the jet stream can be moved around. A major science magazine, and I wish I could remember which one now, I think it was either Science or Nature, in 2003 noted that in 2002 there was a dogleg in the jet stream immediately above the HARP facility, which resulted in a swarm of out-of-season tornadoes in Florida.
Okay. That's a long way away.
Yes, it is.
But if you move the jet stream in one place, it'll have to move elsewhere, I presume.
Exactly. So. It's the downstream effect.
Yeah, yeah.
And with HARP in Gakona, Alaska, in southeastern Alaska, that puts it at the weather front door of North America. The jet stream normally is very near to Gakona, and that's the start point over North American weather. So if you can fiddle with the weather over HARP, you can fiddle with the weather over all of the North American continent.
Yeah, and just for our listeners, the position of the jet stream is it moves. It kind of has a stability for a month or two or three, and then it changes its configuration. But the reason it's important is it becomes the guiding kind of the pathway for storms, the storm track, the mid-latitude storm track where you get westerly winds coming and are just circling the globe from west to east. This is what's called the mid-latitude storm track, and that basically follows the contours, whatever they are, of that particular season of the jet stream, which is why Colorado might get a lot of snow one year and why it might not. The position of the jet stream would affect that.
Exactly. Now, I point out in some articles I've written after weather warfare came out that there is strong evidence that what's going on in North Korea, that is the prolonged North Korean drought, is the result of Chinese manipulation of the weather. China has had an army of what they call weather managers, and at the moment, the Chinese government says they have 37,000 full-time weather managers working on the weather over over China. And weather management there is a blend of mostly cloud seeding techniques to increase precipitation, suppress drought, and some other techniques for dispersing fog from airports. You know, the Summer Olympics are due to open in Beijing in a few days, and this is the height of the rainy season. And Beijing has been claiming since for the last 6 or 8 months that they're going to have, that they can promise perfect weather on opening day. And that's because they have been working in weather management for more than a decade, and they're actually going to be using a technique that was pioneered by the Russians. As you know, the Russians hold their annual May Day parade at the height of the most unstable period in May.